Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you and understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. First of all, I'm going to have to apologize a little bit for my Leonard Cohen voice. It's kind of a nice voice. Makes me want to sing a song. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. About that, a month ago we had a hurricane here in New Bern. And after doing a couple days of work around cutting limbs and everything else, I feel that something was stirred up. And I picked up something, and I usually get sick. Right after that, we had a conference to go to in Phoenix, Scottsdale, and then upon coming back from that, we had to drive up to Boston, near 800 miles, so my wife could have her checkup, annual checkup on her post 7-year meningioma that she had removed after a 13-hour surgery. So all that was good, by the way. All that was good. So today, I would like to focus on, somebody sent in a number of questions in a very thorough way, and I thought it deserved its own podcast. A lot of people will send one question in, and then I sort of wait for the pile to get high enough before I address it as a podcast, or I'll slip it in. So this is from a person named Alessandro. Alessandro, as I understand it, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but a great name. It's the Latin form of the word Alexander, which is from the Greek, Alexandros, and basically means defender of man. Think of Alexander the Great. So it's quite a name. In other words, ultimate warrior, your Marvel image. So the questions for today, to be get right to it, were primarily from Alexandro, and I thought it was really well organized, spot on, and thoughtful. So I'm just going to go through and respond to some of this as a rolling conversation. And so I hope you'll enjoy it. And also, every so often, I want to repeat the larger context of where am I coming from? Have you ever asked yourself, you know, why is this not a more commercially driven podcast? Why is this not sort of monetized in fancier ways? It could be, but I chose not to go there. The reason I chose not to go there is pretty much my reason for being on the ketogenic diet was for my episode of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, which has been put in remission a number of years ago. And there's so many people that suffer with that for decades on whatever medication and so on and so forth. So I went deep into microbiome research. I flew to various international medical conferences to talk to the world experts on what all that was about and who was using various treatments around that, and it was fascinating, but I found it was incomplete to a certain extent, and I found my medical training to be incomplete to a certain extent as well. So, and then my wife, of course, concurrent with my initiation, had meningioma. So, being a physician and having these two negative situations in your own home forced me to re-examine my context for what I knew and the kind of medicine that I was practicing, and then how medicine actually is in this country, which is to address the symptoms. Maybe I was doing it naturopathically. I mean, I had cancer patients and autoimmune and all that, and I feel they got progressively better. Certainly, some got very much better, but I think I could have done a much better job around the concept of the ketogenic diet. Low-carb, high-fat diet, I think, has a tremendous benefit. So with that, I mean, these podcasts are weekly explorations of a topic that's related to that. But the point that I mention that origin, my origin, is because this is continued research going forward. There's still been to many, many, many medical conferences on this. Pretty much know all the speakers by first name, or many of them. And there's many, you know, there's just a lot, not a lot of data when we get to some of these questions. It's about opinion. And so what I look for are speakers that have a lot of either their own experience that really documented. So it's an N of one plus their medical knowledge. Put those together. That's a great conversation. Or you take people like, let's say, Steve Finney or Jeff Volek, the people involved in VertiHealth. They have a whole project of experience, kind of quote unquote, parenthesis around that. And they have their medical training, Jeff Volek's PhD and Steve Finney's an MD. And so that makes those people interesting to listen to. So that's the combination I look. So Dr. Westman is both. And so you know, these are interesting people to listen to and their stories, and they have pretty much an endless reservoir of experience to choose from. Okay. So that's the point. I'm not trying to sell you on the ketogenic diet. I'm going further. I guess this whole thing could be called a deeper dive in keto now, plus 2 years into it, but it's pretty self-serving. It's serving the self of me. And I thought that was worth getting out of the way. That's why these topics that come up are pretty much me driven, and I want to go deeper on it. And especially if I feel there's topics that are not covered very well, you know, they're sort of pushed to the side. They're not looked at, you know. So in a lot of the keto gurus or the keto conferences, there's certain things that aren't going to be talked about. That just, they don't want to go there. And so I hope that's kind of the underlying assumption that you get as well when you listen to this. This is my perspective. So in getting to Alessandro's questions, let's just jump in. He says, personally, I'm trying to embark on the ketogenic lifestyle, but find it difficult to reach the proper amount of proteins and fats. Chronometer, which I talk about a lot. I have no association with chronometer, and the only reason I like that chronometer is that it's better than in terms of me being able to use with clients. I get to see what they're doing, and so I like those features, but it doesn't make it any heads and shoulders better or anything else. But I just like it because I get to know it, and I get to help people out with it. It helps a lot in my path to achieving a keto-balanced macros, but I'm feeling I'm missing something. The only way I can increase fat is by using oils. Mainly olive oil, coconut, MCT sometimes. I have a few issues with digestion, which common tests aren't detecting yet. I really struggle with my gallbladder appendix when I eat my meals, 98% organic, by the way. I take probiotic digestive enzymes, which seems to help a bit. Excluding nuts helps further, but makes it more difficult to reach my goal with proteins and fats. I'm lactose intolerant. I can handle butter, but consider the extensive info provided in a couple of episodes of yours. I have decided to avoid butter as well as ghee. Would palm oil, here's kind of the first question, would palm oil, fair trade, be an option? Let me go back over a couple of these things, okay? So fats in general, let's talk about that. So when we look at olive oil, and you can throw in avocado oil for the most part, we're speaking of, why would you use that? I mean, what's that? That's not bad. It's a oleic acid. All fats are acids, by the way, so I can say that. Nobody calls oleic fat, but it's oleic acid. It's a monounsaturate, and it's the same fat you can find in cow's milk. It's the same fat that's in avocado oil. And so those are fine. It's a monounsaturate. So remember we've gone over fats. Saturated fats are what I call that monofilament. It's just one straight line. And with hash marks, you know, going along, saying every however you want to make those hash marks are where the carbon atoms are. So at 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, it just keeps on going up by twos. So you have saturated fats, which are monofilament. Mono unsaturates means they have a double bond in there someplace. They have one double bond, mono unsaturate. So that's olive oil. So olive oil, avocado, coconut oil, MCT. So coconut oil is a little redundant with MCT. Coconut oil technically is an MCT. Coconut oil is usually combined of two fats, which is C8 and C10, caprylic acid and I think it's myristic acid. But both of those are considered MCTs, medium chain fatty acids. So it's kind of redundant. So coconut oil and MCTs are pretty much the same. When we talk about our MCT, ours is C8 exclusive, and it is from palm. Now, the interesting thing about palm oil is that you have the fruit, and then you have the kernel. So probably the healthiest oil in the world to have, and has been for a couple thousand years, at least in terms of documentation, is palm oil, just squeezed palm oil. That's all they did before, is squeeze the heck out of it. It's also called red palm. So that means you get all these, you get monounsaturates, you get a lot of nutrients. Then you get some nutrients in avocado oil and olive oil as well. With palm oil, now we're just talking about squeezing palm oil. We're not talking about palm oil, the MCT that we have, or anything else. It's just squeezed the old-fashioned way, and it comes out red. The fruit's red, and it's just loaded, absolutely loaded with nutrition. I could do another podcast on that. But the important thing is, if you're going to go in the palm oil direction, is it really has to be RSPO. So not just fair trade. Fair trade really doesn't mean anything in the palm oil world. It means something in the coffee world, or the coffee beans, and it means something in the timber world. But it doesn't mean anything. It's not a term that has any legitimate value. Okay? So RSPO, Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, and you would look for red palm. So RSPO, red palm. It'd probably be expensive. So just sort of peripherally talking about our product. So what is our, if I just said this wasn't about our product and our product is from palm oil, you're right. So when you get into the palm kernel, and just now we're popping out that little seed and we're squeezing this the heck out of that the highest percentage of palm, the highest percentage of any fat from palm oil that you will find in that red palm oil is called palmitic acid. Gee, what a coincidence. It's called palmitic acid, right? So what is palmitic acid? Palmitic acid is a 16-length carbon saturated fat. Some of you are going, I don't want to listen to this episode. It's going to be too much about chemistry. Be that as it may, when you get into keto, you start asking progressively more and more technical questions. And this is exactly how it's gone with Alexandro. And that's good for you. So what they do is they take, and it's the most prolific, oil in the world. And so it has the most number of different fats and mostly saturated fats, but it has mono and, so, and a few others in there. But it has all these other phytonutrients, antioxidants, which the other oils do not have as much at all, if they have it at all. But it has a lot of palmitic acid. So palmitic acid actually is broken down quickly into 2 8s make 16. So an 8 is caprylic acid. So now we're back to the product that we have. So it's the largest supplier of caprylic acid, among other oils in the world, but it pretty much comes from palmitic acid. I hope that was a little bit of sense. It's just saying it's the most prolific plant to produce oils, period. Whether it's coconut or avocado or any of these, it produces more oil per weight on Earth. And that's why it has become, in essence, such a problem. It's been such a successful crop that started in North Africa and was introduced to Southeast Asia, I think over 1,000 years ago. And now it's become, it's palm oil. You hear about palm oil are decimating the jungles and so on and so forth. And they are. But the reason they're doing it is because they're so successful. You get more product, if you will, right? More fruit, more oil. That's the end product. You're getting more oil than any other fruit that you could put there. But the thing is, you need to choose RSPO. And these are, is a big global issue, actually. It's World Wildlife Fund, 2010, I believe, started working with these big companies to saying, you know, wait a minute, can we not kill the whole world because we're planting palm oil that you guys need in your various products, whether you make chocolate bars or baked goods or even aviation oil. I mean, that's how amazing this palm oil is, what you can get. So it's RSPO. You have to go RSPO, and there's a lot of certifications about that, and it's the real thing. And we did an episode on that back. I don't know the number, but it's worth looking into. So that's my deal on that. So relative to the oils, a couple of things. The assumption is that you need to increase your fats. Well, it is high fat and low carb. That's what we call a ketogenic diet, and moderate protein. So It's only initially, really, do you increase your fats. I don't think I increase my fats anymore. I hardly do any sort of brain work on terms of what the ketogenic diet is because I've done it before. Obviously, I was in deep with understanding my macros and so on and so forth. So I don't feel I'm not phobic about having more or less protein or more or less fat. But there's a common sense that it sort of becomes normal. It becomes the natural thing for you to do, but you have to break away from all the processed foods. That's actually the harder thing to leave behind, is the processed foods. If you're only thinking about macros and you're having processed foods, that's a bad deal. You know, that's a pretty screwed up deal. You just don't do that. So it's really about whole foods. To me, after now 2 years of this podcast and I think 6 years of our own lives doing all this, the first step is stepping into whole foods and stopping processed foods. Listen to the three-part interview I did on Joan Iflin about processed foods. It will blow your mind. And then Dr. Christopher Palmer as well. It's a big issue. So stepping into whole foods, step one. Step two is, yes, understand your macros. But initially, you'll have to up your fats because you'll need to feel full. You'll be feeling pretty hungry. How much fat? Well, the way I do it is when I set people up on chronometer, I lock them in at 20 carbs per day. And then I set up their protein requirements. So I calculate them on their ideal body weight. So if it's a woman, 5'8", I look up, and by the way, feel free to go to our Facebook group. I have these documents there and I'm not going to go through it line by line, but I look up the ideal body weight. So if she's 300 pounds overweight, I don't count those 300 pounds overweight. Obviously, I'm making that up. Some people could be that, but I look at their ideal body weight. That's the protein they need for their muscles and tendons and everything else to sustain on a daily basis. So we calculate that, okay, based on that. And so what is that? Well, and this is a number I started like everybody else, started reading the books, The Art and Science of Low-Carb Living, The Art and Science of, I think it was Athletic Training, again by Finney and Volek, and that started, and they've changed their numbers as well over the years. And so I pretty much use 1.5 or to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. I'm going to come back to that later because Alexandra asks about having too much protein. So anyway, so that's how I calculate that. Lock in the carbs at 20. Then I calculate what the proteins are and I get the calories on that. Then I've also calculate what their BMR should be on their ideal body weight. So how many calories they should use. So now I've subtracted the carbs, subtracted the proteins, and now I'm left with this chunk that's just going to be, the rest is going to be fat. So that's how we start. It's a pretty simplistic start, but that's not where you should stay for the rest of your life. This isn't a little box. This isn't a little prison that I put you in or having yourself put yourself in. It's just a place that you get to know about how much protein should you have a day, you know, how much fat. That's a lot of fat, and the fats, you're going to find that your fat's going to drop off. If you have fat to lose, your fat's going to drop off. You'll be using yourself, but it's not going to happen right away. I would say go a couple months and you'll find your fat will, the fat that you consume will drop down and you'll start burning some of your own fat, and that's when you start losing some weight. Alexandro, I'm not quite sure what the reason is you're doing the ketogenic diet, but you're not doing it for weight loss. That's interesting. So I'd say maybe you're doing it for mental clarity, or maybe you're doing it for immune support. I don't know that. That would be helpful to be able to address that, since I don't know that. But that is a lot of fat that people start with, and therefore some of the questions come up, what about my gallbladder? You know, what about digesting all this fat? What about my microbiome? Well, guess what? People do not know. Scientists, quote unquote, there's a lot of he said, she said, whatever. They don't know what a healthy microbiome is. They know definitely what an unhealthy microbiome is. And I mentioned this in a number of podcasts. It's what, you know, it's when that one family or species or whatever of bacteria primarily is overproducing. So they say, well, why is this overproducing? You know, and then it's usually because they've had antibiotics, or it's not usually dietarily induced, or they've something they're eating or something they're exposed to, or the history of antibiotics. That's what you call C. diff. That's how you get there. So they really don't know what a healthy, they used to be, oh, well, you need everything evenly distributed. No, now they're realizing that, you know, having, if one has a high fat diet, relatively speaking to the standard American diet, which is high carb and high fat, is that a high fat diet makes its own, your microbiome, which is viruses and bacteria and archaea and fungal parts actually do very well. They do quite fine. And there's a number of papers that have come out. It's not etched in stone, by the way, to say this is now the healthiest microbiome. No, it's not. These are all very new sort of topics to be digging into. But the important thing to extract from that is that it's not bad to have a high-fat diet. It's not like bad for your microbiome. So the issues of, oh, I need to have a balanced microbiome. Or, okay, what exactly is your balanced microbiome? I don't know. I think I'm supposed to have some plants. So I don't know. I think I should have some fiber. I don't know how to answer to those. Those are kind of just not substantiated concepts. And so concepts that are falling by the side are, do you need to eat plants at all? Do you need to have any carbs? We know they're not essential. You have essential proteins and you have essential fats, but you don't have any essential carbs. And so therefore, the concept of fiber, which is not inert, does have caloric. It varies per type of fiber. Well, shouldn't we have fiber for our microbiome? Well, that's a concept we're borrowing from the last 50 years saying, well, that's valid. Maybe that's not. Maybe we will have a healthy microbiome with a ketogenic diet. So now what evolves? After you get through this technical window of knowing where your macros are on, and I do suggest you track them, you got to get real in terms of saying, okay, what does this look like? And how much protein? Now we're talking about protein. And it's harder to do it as a vegetarian and as a vegan. I can certainly attest to that in terms of clients thereof. But proteins are really going to be animal protein. It's going to be mammalian protein, fish, poultry, and that's about it. Those are big categories. And you're going to get to be able to eyeball how much of a steak do you have. And also, when we get to animal protein, you really are going to have to address the issue of head to tail. I'm not saying you're going to have brains and eyeballs and so on and so forth, but you're going to have to sort of open up the big picture and not just have muscle meat. And why I say that, because the nutrition of what they call organ meats, such as liver, kidney, and spleen, and so on and so forth, but at the very least liver, is huge. I mean, that's the highest source of choline and B12 and folic acid. So if you're not having liver, you're not going to get as much. You're going to get very little of some of these components. I don't know if you get any choline in steak, but consequently, you're going to have a number of problems, neurologic and elsewise. So when you enter into keto and trying to be an open-minded person stepping away from processed food and into whole foods, you're going to have to think about these organ meats. So if you went to just liver, that's great. So now when we pretend we go back 1,000 years in time and see what they ate, they did eat everything. You know, they boiled those bones down. So they had bone broth as a daily soda, so to say. It was always there. So they had that. Bone broth would be another one, by the way, to have, because you're getting a lot of things in the form of how you're getting it that is very diverse. I was about to say holistic, but that's an overused word. But it's very diverse and very broad and very soothing to your gut, by the way. That's how we entered into ketogenic diet, was for learning how to make bone broth. And you'll be experts before you know it. And liver, I'd say those two things you really need to include at some point. And don't just be, I'm having lamb or I'm having chicken or I'm having this. That's fine. But chicken liver is another great thing to have. But it's liver. So you don't have to go to brain, you don't have to go to the other organs, but if you're never going to consider doing liver, if you're never going to consider doing bone broth, then I don't think it's going to be a healthy diet for you. So that's the bottom line. That's what I've learned in the course of 2 years. And Alexandra, I'm talking more about you and more about the questions. I'm not pointing to you specifically. So I hope you pick that up. But that's it. And that's the bottom line people don't want to hear. So let me progress there. So we talked about fats. And so, all right, struggle with gallbladder and appendix. So if one's increasing their fat initially and they have these problems, yeah, you're going to have some sensitivity. It's going to be a transition. So there's a couple of things you can do. One is you transition slowly, but knowing eventually you're probably going to be dropping down your fats because you just don't need to. You don't need to have that much fat if you're fat enough to lose fat, if you're fat enough. But your body will step up. And your gallbladder is nothing but a sac with a slight muscular structure to it, a sphincter that squeezes out the bile from your liver that's been accumulated. So when and I'm leading up to, some people don't have gallbladders and they ask, is this a problem? No, it's not a problem. So I would say go slowly. And yes, temporarily, you could have digestive enzymes, which are things like ox bile. Those are lipases. And in essence, you're borrowing somebody else's bile, which is emulsifies your fats. So if one has gallstones, which means that they have had a bad diet for a while, some hormonal influence there for sure, but it's mostly about the bad diet, that they get these blockages, these stones in their gallbladder, in their gallbladder sac, in essence. And so every time it gets squeezed to squeeze out some bile to emulsify the fats that are coming down through your intestine, it's going to be a painful squeeze. And so with time, your body adapts. But that's how people transition, is through adding of something like ox bile, a lipase. But that ends up not being necessary after a while. You mentioned about probiotics. Probiotics are more about microbiome. I don't say there's any necessity. The only way and why I use probiotics is if you ever have to be on a antibiotic, it's a good way of taking probiotics so you don't get wiped out with your probiotic, with your antibiotic completely. Okay. All right. Always think about having water throughout the day. Not a lot of water, but I just put that in there because often it wasn't mentioned here. So now we know about palm oil, why that's it. So you're underweight. Now, here we go. Last but not least, from what I heard, the calories a person needs daily varies depending on the number of meals. 3 meals, X, 2 meals, less than X, 1 meal, way less than X. You know, I've never heard that. You're sort of talking about intermittent fasting in reverse. And so the idea, when you're trying to get the maintenance, so you don't need to lose weight. So you're trying to get the maintenance. We're going to assume your BMR, your basal metabolic rate, is kind of standard. And so the question comes, if you're going to have one meal, that's a big meal of a lot of calories. So most people, at least we are at this point, that we have primarily a dinner and we have a small lunch. And I'm fine with that. I don't have breakfast and that's it. So I don't think the fewer meals you have, you need fewer calories. I think that's an erroneous assumption, and I'll dismiss that because I just don't believe in it, so I can't address it. Figure out a way of understanding how many calories and proteins my body requires when eating only once or twice a day. Well, once you do those macros, figure it out. After that, you're just slicing it up. You're saying, do I have one meal? Do I have two meals? Do I have three meals? You know, here's my main meal, and here's my two snack meals, two minor meals. And so that's entirely up to you how you want to break it down. But I would stay within the collective average of what your total BMR is with those macros you've already calculated, and try to be as whole foods oriented as possible. Okay? That's simple, but that's how I think. Okay, and you mentioned a concept of saying some experts, there you go, whoever they are, consider oil as liquid sugar. So they don't quite agree with the facts that we should use them. Instead, that we should eat whole fruits, olives, coconuts. However, as I see it, that would ram up carbs as well. But I don't know what the experts are, and the whole idea of oil as liquid sugar, I have no idea of what that is. I would go back. So if I was to have to make that statement correct, which I don't think is correct, is that I would say in your body has the ability to make any glucose it needs. So it makes its carbohydrates for you as you need them. That's called gluconeogenesis. It can make nearly all your proteins except for those 8 essential and 1 conditionally essential amino acid. So it's a lot that it can make. So the liquid sugar, I don't know where to go with that. And I'll leave it at that. Does that mean that we cannot do bulletproof coffee? I personally do some sort of light bulletproof maca with coconut oil, sometimes NCT, for a total of 250 kilocalories. Well, the whole idea of bulletproof, I think, is stupid. You know, I was thinking of a better word, but sometimes when you're slightly congested, you just go with blunt. So I put some oil in my coffee. I long ago stopped doing the whole blender thing. I think it's having that much fat and scarfing it down. But you're an exception in the sense that you're not about fat loss. You would be pulling a lot of fat into your system, and you definitely would provoke a gallbladder problem if you don't have one. I mean, it's just so unnatural, completely unnatural. they're you know, step in the concept of whole foods again. So when I say what I put in my coffee now, and it's kind of evolved, and you don't need to copy me. I'm just saying I'm doing what works with me. As I do put in some C8, and I put it in with collagen, and I add a little stevia because I like a little sweet. That's where I cross into the sweet line, not much, just a little bit. And why do I like that? It really is my go-to, and I have that at 12. I don't have anything in my coffee before 12, and so I have that at 12, and it simply allows me to focus all the way on up to dinner. So I like that. I do that kind of for mental clarity, and there you go. If they have to be at my desk or on the laptop or doing something, you know, long, boring hours or something or other. There you go. Okay. I hope that sort of answered the question. So I don't think a big wallop of fat like that is both healthy, especially since you asked about your fat. And I think that you basically have to think about, you know, how did people eat? Nobody had fatty coffees before. It's a total contrivance. It's you're following one man's inane marketing ploy that he did very well in terms of getting out there. But no, it's not natural, and I don't think it's healthy. Would the use of 100% fat cacao butter be similar to using coconut oil? Well, I like fat cocoa butter, I'm going to call it. I like cocoa butter because it's a little more whole foods oriented than coconut oil. Coconut oil, as I already said, it's two fats. It came from coconut, so you can say that's a whole foods too. Correct. But cocoa butter, which is expensive, that's oleic acid, the same thing in olive oil, it's the same thing in cow milk, it's the same thing in avocado oil, and palmitic and stearic acid. So palmitic, remember, it's the C16, and stearic is C18. They break it, those are saturated fats, remember, monofilament line. Simple fat to break down, lopping off carbons. And so both of those are good. A good healthy amount of saturated fat and a mono. I'm good with that. So there isn't an ideal fat, by the way. I think mixing up your fats, and I have, you know, what do I do in life? My fats come from primarily the food I eat. So I have liver. I have my meats with the fat on it. So whether it's tenderloin, that's nice, ribeye or chicken with the skin on it, pork, lamb chop, so on. Try to keep it as fatty as possible. So that's where I get mine. So having different kinds of fats, I think, is more important than looking for an ideal profile of what a fat should have. Okay. I think that's illusionary. I don't think there is such a thing. I think variation is your safer bet. Okay, how much protein do we actually need? And you sent me a link to Dr. Eric Berg's presentation, and I thought that was interesting, and I think he's following traditional thinking, and I think he's an era that is going on. Information has been presented, but not his own experience. So what I mean by that is he talked about his breakdown of what fats, what grams were needed per pounds. And that's fine. And he did pounds because we're in the United States and people think in terms of pounds. They don't think in terms of kilos. But however, all research is in terms of grams per body weight, grams per kilo of body weight. So that's just the way it is. Mercola does the same thing. He's off on his own trying to make his own little measurements. But if you want to compare it to research papers you're going to read about, it's grams of protein per kilograms of body weight. There's 2.2 pounds in a kilo. And so he gave me his numbers, and it really works out in my in the world's way of looking at it, 0.8 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Totally agree with that. That's fine. But what it implies and what he talked about, well, if you have too much, it puts a strain on your kidneys, Well, guess what? You should ask somebody like that. It really annoys me when somebody speaks academically with no freaking experience to back it up. If he said, you know, I had a patient that came in. And so what you have to balance that, and a lot of doctors, by the way, do get irritated when somebody says, you know, there's no upper limit of protein. Well, first of all, it's really hard to have that much protein in your daily diet. You know, it's just not there. You have what is common sense. You have your steak. You don't say, now, if I could have five steaks, do you know anybody eats five steaks? No, they have pretty much all that they can eat. They're satiated with the fat and the meat that they have. So when he was saying, well, this is what you should have, you have more, you put a strain on a kidney. Well, guess what? In dealing with that question, and I've seen that question asked, and I've looked into it myself, there is no example of anybody who's ever had strained kidneys who didn't already, here's the preface, here's the disclaimer, who did not already have a kidney problem. So for all those people that don't have a diagnosis and don't, you know, they go in and get their blood work, they don't have a kidney problem, they can have as much meat as they want. You know, and so that, and there's YouTubes, you want to follow YouTubes. Look at carnivory if you want to. And Sean Baker, who's an orthopedist, big guy, and an Olympic contender, and he had the world record in weightlifting of some sort, powerlifting. So he's a big guy, strong. And so he has up to, you know, 3.5 grams of protein. 3.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. That's huge. That's twice the upper limit of what this guy here that you referenced, Dr. Eric Berg. So that's strongly contested. I hope you get that. So working too much by the numbers gets to be pretty unnatural. So this whole window of going through the macros, which I do encourage people to go through and do, they got to leave it after they do that. You know, they weigh their foods, they get to understand things, and they're waiting for their body to adapt to become reasonable. And again, that's after first step, which is to go into the whole foods. Okay, what is the impact on liver when doing ketosis? Continued fatty acid conversions, any impact on the liver panel we should be aware of? Well, I don't know where you're starting from. So if you're starting from your happy liver, I don't expect anything to be wrong. Some people do have an increase in total cholesterol and LDL, and I could care less because those values are no longer important to me and many other docs like me. And so we look for the change in triglycerides, and we look for it, which ideally get your triglycerides around 70 and your HDL. Mine are now over 100, about 105. And as a doc, when I was practicing, you bet I was looking for those lipid panel numbers. And anybody who had, you know, total cholesterol over 250, oh my gosh. Well, my total cholesterol is 300 and my LDL is 190. But my HDL is 105, I think was the last one, and my triglycerides are 60, I believe. That's perfect. Absolutely perfect. So when you start having higher fats in your diet, you may see some of your lipid panel, which is not the same as your liver panel, I understand, increase. And you can, I would say, then see Dave Fellman, cholesterolcode.com. He's all about, if you actually have a week, I think it's a week he does, of a lot of fat. So if you have a lot of fat, way more than you need, you're going to find out when you actually go in and get your lipid panel, your cholesterol will actually go down. Uh-huh. So that's an interesting question, but it also invalidates the test because when you go in to have a lipid panel, you're supposed to fast for 12 hours. So just, you know, so some people go in, they fasted for 3 days. Well, that's a stupid person doing that. They should just do what's required. Fast for 12 hours, not 3 days. And don't eat abnormally just to manipulate the test unless you're doing some experiment like Dave Fellman is, because he's brought in a whole line of interesting questions to have. But in terms of giving a test and the valid of that test relative to all the everybody else's numbers and the range and so on and so forth, just fast for 12 hours, you know, have the diet you normally have and let that be the numbers, but you might see some changes. Doing keto diet, is as dangerous as gallbladder? No. There may be some transition. We talked about lipases and ox bile with regard to milk. Would ghee be better? Yeah, it's better. I mean, it's basically butter with the casein taken out. I don't do, for whatever reason, I just don't do dairy. I am so strong in the no dairy camp, and I love cheese. I mean, I do make my exceptions, by the way, but there are once or two months in between. And why that is because I have the 16 years of clinical experience. And if I did nothing else, did acupuncture and a lot of oriental medicine and naturopathic and environmental medicine and genomic work. But if you just took dairy completely, took dairy out of everybody's diet who I had ever seen, that and wheat or gluten would be a better idea, you'd see 90% improvement of everybody. That's how generalized that is. So dairy is just a whopping big deal and people love it and they find it hard to give it up. So I say, go 2 months, give it up completely, bring back in your favorite thing, see how that affects you. And now you know what you have to discipline yourself about. Now, I do believe that there is some required discipline in doing life in a healthy way. It just doesn't come easily. When we referred to diets of 1,000 years ago, it wasn't that they were disciplined. They were eating what was available to them, the only things that was available to them. Now we're in a different situation in which we have to self-impose certain rules, if you will, where certain better understandings of dietary necessities, given we can have everything. Okay, what about kefir made with real grains? I wouldn't go there. You can go there and you can tell me how you feel. I just don't do grains. You know, my origin into this is where it was about gut issues, just not going there. And I'm fine with the life I have, you know. Not that you're asking about my life. It's just that I just don't think that grains, you know, there's a lot of historical evidence that grains were the beginning of the end. So kefir is a better form of grains, no doubt. So play with it. You tell me. As far as I understand, fat stores potential energy. Oh, toxins in fat. This was, in my earlier days of practice, was a big, big deal. So the idea that most toxins are bioaccumulated in fats. That's why tuna, if you have tuna, you know, the big tunas, they have bioaccumulated all the tuna of all the fish that they've eaten and the fish that those ate. So that's why they're high in mercury and others. But mercury is the most noteworthy, especially with tuna. So that's all about fat, the fat in the fish. And a fatty fish is wonderful. So if it wasn't for those environmental toxins, tuna and all these big fish would be wonderful to have. And now they're not wonderful to have because we polluted the world. Well, there again, we have to sort of superimpose that particular knowledge, not to never have tuna, but not to always have tuna, is the way I look at it. So how did those toxins relate to having a diet high in fat? That's a great question. I'll tell you my answer to this. You have to be aware of the food you're eating. Where did it come from? So we like to get free range meats. We hardly eat any vegetables anymore. So the nice thing about not eating vegetables, we don't have to worry about all the pesticides and herbicides and insecticides used on plants. You know, we don't have to worry about them being organic or not organic. But I think there's a lot of fictitious claims about organic. I like organic, the concept, that is, don't have these chemicals on your food. An environmental working group has a great list of what are the worst plants to eat, called the Dirty Dozen, and then they call it the Clean 15. And they started doing the research about 10 or 15 years ago. They certainly have my respect. Okay, so is there any supplements to take? I wouldn't go that far. I would just say, here on out, be aware of what you're having and stay away from foods that you know are probably going to be high in certain toxins, i.e. the tuna. And you can look these. It's mostly fish, by the way. And try to get healthier sources. In terms of protecting us, and you're sort of verging on the issue of how do I get rid of toxins and so on, that's a whole nother topic. We'll defer to another time if there's enough interest in that. Okay, I think I covered a lot. I'm probably going to find out I missed. Here's one. If doing fasting, 16 hours for intermittent fasting, 16, 8, 24, 4, would a bulletproof coffee take a person out of fasting and inhibit apoptosis? Yes, it would. So when you fast, you don't eat food. Food is fat. So fat is, you're taking people out of, I know you're thinking you're keeping them in ketosis, no doubt, but you're breaking your fast. So you can say you're continuing the ketosis, but you can't say you're continuing the fast. And so people put qualifiers in front of the word fasting. They'll say protein sparing fast, the idea that you're only having protein. And you're fasting around that. Everything else is fasted, meaning you're not having fats and you're not having carbs. Well, there's fats and protein, I mean, and meat for sure, but except for that, you're not adding any extra fats. And there's a water fast. There's a bone broth fast. So these different fasts are qualifiers. And the degree you have anything caloric, it's going to, you know, take you out of that fast. You're no longer going to be fasting, but there's different reasons to do that. There's even a fat fast. I've not done that. And I've done protein sparing fasts, which I think are very good. The nice thing about a protein sparing fast is your metabolic rate does not decrease. As you'll find when you do a water fast and you have coffee and teas and so on and so forth, that your metabolic rate starts to decrease. I mean, that's been well documented, so this isn't new. But when you have a protein sparing fast, your metabolic rate does not decrease because you're getting enough protein that you've already calculated. Okay, so Alexandra, You get back to me and tell me if I missed anything, and I hope I hit your high points. I really appreciate the fact that you lined this up so well and asked your questions, and you really thought about this. And I can tell you're into the technical beginning, and let there be a natural approach to bring, you know, so, and I think it does become, it has to be doable and it has to be natural. You can't box yourself in. I mean, you know, the novelty of doing this will make you be statistically correct and so on and so forth. But you catch people as you start, just like when the Dr. Berg video said, I've not seen any problem with having more protein than the 0.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. But, and that's what I, you know, I've looked at my own blood test and others, and so I don't see that problem. But, and there also, it's really hard to have a lot of protein if you're having fat there with it as well. I do add some fats. I do add some C8 on some of my foods, but we make our own mayo, and mayo is my backup for everything. I'll mix it with something and I'll have it on the side. That will be the dip for the side. And that's about as far as I go. That's not too boring if you like meat, and we make a liverwurst in essence. And so this is my way of trying to bring in whole foods into a kind of a doable daily health supporting role. All right. I hope that helped you. I hope that answered everything. So till next time, I'll answer a number of other questions, but I've been behind on this for various reasons. Take care, and looking to hear from your questions again. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp. I just wanted to encourage you to send in your questions to drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Many of you have, and so what I've done with these questions that gotten back to most of the people I email, but some of the questions that were so good, and if they were overlapping to other questions, I would combine them and try to put that into the topic of a podcast, either via one of the micro topics that are covered in an interview. As you know, we cover a lot of topics in any given interview, or some of my own sort of reporting, if you will, on some of these issues. So please keep the questions coming. Feel free to send in an email, and I will get back to you. One thing I want to say, a number of questions have come in which I've given this answer and the email didn't work. So just make sure that you're receiving at the same email that you sent it in. And I think that might have been the difficulty. So I look forward to your questions. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I'm hoping to answer your questions. And I think this world of keto is not just black and white. You know, it's nice that it's simple, but it's not simple for some. I'm really trying to, you know, go down, as anybody, any of you who have listened to all my podcasts, we started way back when, history of evolution and epilepsy and so on and so forth. You know, now we're seeing some tremendous overlap in various mental disorders, such as schizophrenia or neurological disorders that are not just epilepsy. And also, just for people in losing weight, it's sometimes pretty complicated for them to engage in keto, and so they need some help. And so that's the whole point of, at least that's what I think I'm doing, is exploring the world of why are there other factors. So in exploring some of those other factors, we've covered addiction, we've covered hormones, we've covered nutritional deficiencies, we've covered certain metabolic lab results, and we'll go further. We'll even get to more on genome and aspects. So these are all just contributions that make for an obstacle for some people to engage easily in the ketogenic diet. This is my belief, and these are the things that I've discovered. And I think other people have discovered some of these things, but not ever put them together. So stay listening, send in your questions, and I will definitely get back to you.